From KQED Public Radio and the California Report, this is the Capital Notes podcast for Friday, November 4th. I'm John Myers from KQED, and Anthony York from the Los Angeles Times is in here with me. And it's
again. Two in a row.
Wow. You should be careful. I don't want you to hurt yourself or something, you know, getting over here to talk politics with us. It's already November. Was it just me or did I blink and miss October? Personal aside, or actually it must not be much of an aside if I start the podcast that way. But so we are.
You were on vacation, weren't you?
October. Yeah, I was on, September-ish. Anyway, okay. I was on home improvement project assignment.
That's where I am now. By the way, if anybody needs a rental in the Midtown Sacramento neighborhood, very cute, two-bedroom, one-bath, kind of weird landlord, but pleasant wife, contact your local podcasters.
Who also would be the landlord there, one of the podcasters. I'm nowhere near that project. And he's got a new home that he has to now fix.
Yeah, and if anybody wants to help us paint, give me a call.
Yeah, you know, there are probably some people who do that. First week of November, can't help but also note that we're about a year away from Election Day statewide.
Yeah.
And there'll be a lot of interesting things that happen in the next 12 months, I would assume, that'll influence what we're talking about come November 2012. Partly gets us to where we're going today, though I thought kind of the my own unofficial or official, I guess, theme of the podcast would be about the politics of money, a couple of interesting money for different reasons of money, a couple of interesting money-related stories in the news this week. And why don't we start with pensions?
Okay.
Because that's the big – they're both big in their own way, but that's the biggie in lots of political and financial ways. So this week we had the – I don't know how long we've all been talking about that there was going to be the conservative hammer pension initiative introduced and circulated and possibly getting on the ballot, that whatever was going on inside the legislature about fixing, modifying, changing public employee pensions was going to get influenced by a conservative hammer. Now, nobody really knew what the hammer was going to look like. I mean, not for sure.
The hammer minus $3 million looks mighty small, we'll get there. We'll get there.
The hammer from a policy perspective, though, is a pretty interesting – is a pretty weighty document, I think. And so we saw this week on Wednesday, we saw two versions of the initiative. We might as well call it a proposal from a group of Republicans who have an interest in the issue – both in and out of state government. And I want to talk about one of the members of the group, too, who's well-known in state Republican Party politics. But their proposal goes further than Jerry Brown's proposal. One version of their proposal – let's see if I say this right, Anthony. You can fact-check me. One version of their proposal is Brown's proposal plus more requirements from current employees. And that gets to the unfunded liability of what's on the books for pensions and meeting their obligations. The second version goes much further and would effectively turn the pension system in California for public employees into a 401k plan.
Right.
With a few.
It's sort of like the Whitman plan and the Brown plan. Kind of.
Brown plus and
– although this one affects public safety, so I guess you can't call it the Whitman plan. Yeah.
Brown plus and Whitman minus.
Okay.
How about that? I like that. So let's talk about first of all, just the bigger context, and we can get to the details here, and I'm sure we'll throw through them. But the politics of this is fascinating to me because now you've got the Democratic governor with a plan that was reacted to not well by organized labor. You've got a Republican group within an initiative that is even worse in their minds. And then what do you get out of the legislature? What becomes of the negotiating, the legegislative process, and the rest of it? It's there's some dicey politics.
Well, but this is a familiar path, right? Oftentimes, we've seen an initiative used as a threat to try to facilitate a legislative deal, right?
Some successfully, some not.
Right. We saw it happen with workers' comp in 2004. That worked out successfully, and other times has not worked out so well. The main question, I believe, on the conference call yesterday, it was you who raised the question. But we were all thinking, this proposal put forward by Mike Geneste, a former Schwarzenegger finance director, and Dan Pelissier, and another former Schwarzenegger administration official and former state party chairman, Duff Sundheim. The real question is, who's going to fund this? Who's going to fund this to get on the ballot? Who's going to give this initiative $3 million to get on the ballot, let alone the $30 million you would need to fight labor on?
And that's assuming it only takes $3 million, which we could talk about.
We could talk about that, too. And it sort of speaks to a larger question about the pension issue. It's kind of a good government issue, right? A lot of people believe that there should be some changes and some scaling back to the public pension system going forward. However, there's no constituency that is directly impacted by it, right? Number one, any savings that you're talking about, by and large, the bulk of the savings is going to affect new hires. So you're talking about when those people who haven't even been hired yet retire. You're talking 25 years down the line for the real savings for most of these proposals. And there's nobody who benefits directly from that savings right now. I mean, you can make an argument that, well, anybody who's funded by state services should want pension reform because if it eats up more of the state budget.
But it's a good point. I mean, it doesn't have a constituency for change. I mean, it certainly has a constituency for the status quo, and that would be organized labor.
Sure.
But in the same way that we saw all of those, like, electoral reforms, they didn't really have a constituency crying out for change redistricting, change primaries. I mean, at least not in the convention.
Well, and redistricting even is more political. At least with the redistricting, there's more of a, people believe that if it was left to a partisan legislature, a Democratic-controlled legislature and a Democratic governor, that the state would have been carved up in ways that would have been even more detrimental to Republicans, right? So there is, even in those sort of good government reforms, there is a political constituency there. It doesn't really exist for the pensions issue, and it really sort of begs the question. It's the question, and it's a question that faces the governor's proposal, too. I mean, what is his leverage to try to motivate Democratic lawmakers to vote for something that Democrats and a lot of folks in organized labor who support Democrats don't like?
Well, and that, and also kind of what happens now with this proposal being to the right of the governor, as we lay out that political spectrum of who's where. I mean, you and I and others, we're all sat after Governor Brown put his idea on the table and thought, how much political capital is he going to expend? How serious is he about this? And now you wonder it again in the context of, does this help? Does this hurt? Does this have an impact? Does this push labor to the table? Because if they can get it on the ballot, if the backers of this can get it on the ballot, I mean, that's a whole different fight.
Right.
I mean, I think you're right. I want to go back to the money for a minute. I think you're right about the how do you fund the campaign? And that was a question that we asked on the conference call. $3 million is their number on an assumption of roughly $2 a signature. And I think that is dependent on what the economics of signature gathering are in 2012.
Now that everything's in November, right?
Because who knows what else is going to come down the pike. What's that?
I do.
You know it
no,
all.
I do.
Just tell us right now. I could take a few more weeks off.
I have no idea.
So that's a number that could be in flux. Running a campaign could be a number in flux. But I would suspect that if someone got this on the ballot, it might flush out some of the money that would be sitting on the sidelines about whether or not they wanted to spend it on it. People who are like reticent to commit to a political effort to revamp pensions until they actually see it on the ballot. Because once it's on the ballot, I think organized labor has to take it as real.
Right.
And look at the 2012 ballot. I mean, they're already facing a measure that they're very worried about, the initiative that would curb their political spending by limiting what they can do with the dues of their paying members. They've got legislative and congressional races they want to play in because they want to make their impact. They think they could get a bigger majority, maybe a supermajority in one house or the other in Sacramento.
Potential revenues
that the governor's looking for in a tax package. I mean, again, I don't want to it's not necessarily doom and gloom, but if you're organized labor right now, you got to be sitting there really thinking, wow, I've got to figure out the chess moves here. This is
right.
There's a lot of moving parts.
I think you're right that once this thing qualifies for the ballot, labor would have to mobilize resources to try to defeat it, depending on which proposal is introduced. And that is part of a larger chess game and part of, that's It's the best tool Republicans have in their playbook right now is to try to put things on the ballot to get Democrats to spend their money. And the question is, if we see, you know, this paycheck initiative on the ballot, we see a pensions initiative on the ballot, does that sort of set off the nuclear war, right, that's been threatened
for
years?
The all against all.
Right, where, I mean, what would then prevent CTA from putting a split roll, you know, Prop 13 initiative on the ballot, or a tobacco tax or an oil severance tax? I mean, just to totally, I mean, if we're going to just spend money just for the sake of spending money and getting the other side to spend down their resources while political consultants get their 15%, you know, that's a possibility. And the question is, I think it's an open question, is what effect does this have on this initiative and other initiatives that might be potential bargaining chips of fostering some sort of brokered compromise that includes a legislative solution and perhaps a detente on some of these other issues that could, you know, cost folks hundreds of millions of dollars to try to campaign for and against.
I mean, certainly you mentioned the past as maybe prologue here. I mean, workers' comp in 2004, Arnold Schwarzenegger and a group of conservative activists worked on an initiative faced with the signatures being submitted because, as we all know, once you put something on the ballot, you can't get it off. You may be able to technically orphan it, but it's there. Faced with putting the signatures on the ballot, the legislature acted and a workers' comp plan happened. Of course, sometimes the legislature doesn't pay attention. 1978, Prop 13 didn't quite work out the way they wanted it to. It worked out the way others wanted it to in California. You know, and on and on and on. I mean, you know, Schwarzenegger's year of reform in 2005, it didn't work out for him at the ballot. I mean, there is a lot of that dynamic, you're right, in using the levers of direct democracy and legislative government kind of against each other in ways.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I talked this week to one of the vocal critics on pensions, Marcia Fritz, an accountant from
who is not part of this group. We need to be clear.
No, she is not. And she is, and she wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times this week coming out in favor of the governor's proposal. And she said, I mean, she told me that she would even support a tax increase if this some sort of tax increase proposal, if a pension proposal was also on the ballot. And that's the other dynamic here for labor to consider is if they want more revenues. You know, the case, and we talked about this a little bit last week, but the case the governor has long made is we have to show voters that we're doing things to get the state's fiscal house in order if we're going to dig into their wallets again. And so before we ask them to send us another check, we've got to show them that, hey, we're going to spend this money responsibly. And pensions, as much as the policy reform and the long-term savings, you know, might, I mean, again, there's not big savings in the short term, at least on the state level for these pension proposals. But politically, it may help sort of reinforce this notion that, hey, state government is trying the best they can under some adult supervision to get its act together. So,
well, there's certainly not a short-term savings from the governor's plan. There is a more substantial, though not quite fully calculated yet from what they told us, savings in the short run from the Republican initiative.
From the first initiative, right? The non-Brown initiative.
Yeah,
Whitman minus initiative.
Well, either one, Brown plus or Whitman minus, there's more of a short-term savings. Because even if you look at the lesser of the two versions of the Republican initiative, it clearly says that it would give the power, theoretically, if the courts held supported it, and that's a big if here,
right.
A big if. It would allow state governments and local governments to cap how much they contributed to those pension funds, to those pension obligations of existing employees.
Right.
And would therefore mean, under the Brown plan, which he says it should be a 50-50 split, it would now it would allow the government to do less than 50, therefore requiring workers to do more than 50.
Right.
There's also a huge issue, a huge hammer, I think, in the way these initiatives talk about calculating unfunded liability.
Right.
And would force CalPERS and CalSTRS and others that dabble, but they're the two biggies, to use the pension accounting methods of the private sector rather than the public sector, which are more stringent, which are assume less percentage return, and therefore would make that unfunded liability probably shoot up rather than north of $100 billion, north of $400 or $500 billion, across the state when you look at all the funds. And so that would mean even bigger annual contributions from workers. Now, while they apparently phase this in, they say a worker's 3%. Annual contribution can't be more than 3% a year. There is no language as to saying how long a worker would have to pay more than 50% of their retirement needs.
And they made clear yesterday there was no, even though it's capped at a 3% increase per year, there's no total cap.
Yeah.
You know, that was something that they made clear on the call yesterday. So,
and those are, I guess my point really quickly, those are big hammers and they're big and they're policy issues, but they also go back to the politics. If somebody can get the money to get this on the ballot, you're all against all kind of thing. Conservative money that might have been sitting on the sidelines otherwise sees that and sees a way to make a major long-going change and a political argument, like save this money out of pensions and we give it to schools. We give it to, We give it to help the needy. I mean, everything that Democrats normally would be arguing for.
Right. Well, you know, I think the fact that they unveiled two proposals yesterday and or earlier this week and it shows just how early days we are in this debate. I mean, it remains to be seen whether these proposals or something like them, you know, sort of overlaps with what's going on in the legislature. I mean, the governor himself was well aware of the timing of these initiatives, and I think that's part of the reason why the governor's office accelerated their timeline to get their own pension proposal out, was to sort of get out in front of this initiative proposal. So
it's also clear, too, that I think that the governor's office welcomed having something to the right of him on this issue.
Yeah, well,
knowing
perfect,
the politics that we know,
because it puts where he wants to be.
It puts him in a more comfortable position of saying, you know, look, guys, look where I am.
Yeah, and it gives him some leverage to go to labor and say, hey, guys, look, I mean, this thing could actually qualify. And then even if you win, you could end up losing, right, for all the reasons we discussed. So
the other thing I was going to just briefly note is that the $3 million, and again, it could be more than $3 million, depending on what it takes to actually qualify it. There was no mistaking why the labor group that's been fighting pension issues came out as strongly as they did yesterday, given that reality that once you get it on the ballot, it's a different conversation.
Right.
Dave Lowe, who is the chairman of that coalition of union folks who
Checkers.
Have been talking on pensions. Is that what the acronym is?
That's how that's the term they – yeah, Checkers. It's C-H.
Californians for – lay it out for me.
I don't know.
Okay.
Checkers.
Dave Lowe, who's a union official, though, and is the chair of this coalition, said in the comment to me for the story I ran on radio on Thursday morning, said, anybody who gives money to this automatically becomes public enemy number one to us.
Yeah.
That is a not very subtle way of saying, we will not forget if you help fund the signature drive to get this on the ballot.
They do have long memories over there, too.
Slightly. So the politics of that is very interesting to me, and I do think it'll be a fascinating watch to see how it gets played into the budget, into electoral issues, into all these other things we're looking at.
It's sort of a weird reprise of last year, right? I mean, a lot of the issues that were unresolved, namely the revenue increases and the pensions, and I mean, how long before we start talking about a spending cap? And we're going to hear about trigger cuts here soon, I'm sure. So, I mean, I think a lot of these issues that were in the forefront last year, guess what? They're back in the fore this year, and you know, it is California politics after all.
Let me ask you a question on this, and then we'll move on to the topic two about money this week. Given that the governor's proposal was so closely mirrored the proposal from Republicans in the state Senate, you can play the he said, she said game of who offered what when during the budget negotiations, and let's not rehash that. But given that the governor's plan does mirror in a lot of ways that plan, the hybrid 401k and things like that.
Retirement age, yeah.
Yeah. Could not Republicans in the legislature have a play here that would help them in some way if they went to the governor immediately and said, we can give you basically the whole caucus. Like, in other words, if they could be aligned, if they could be united, you know, we'll give you all the votes for this, and therefore put pressure on Democrats in the building in between them and the governor. Because, I mean, the governor, whether or not he puts a lot of capital behind this, political capital behind pensions, he has staked this out as this is what he believes in.
Well, remember,
this is his proposal.
But this was part of a deal last year. I mean, I think maybe that and a vote for tax increases, then maybe you're talking. I mean, that was the deal last year. So if the Republicans said, hey, we'll give you all of our votes for this proposal, plus some votes for tax increases, too. We'll give you four for tax increases. Then we might have something to talk about. But barring that, I mean, given the Republican reaction, I think that most, if not all, the Republican votes are there for the governor's proposal. I mean, pretty close, you know. I mean, you saw statements from all of the four senators who were negotiating with the governor on the pension issue this spring. Come out and say that they would support the plan. And so I don't think that would be a political earthquake to say, hey, we're all there. I mean, you know, if they had a way of bringing it up on the floor somehow, which they don't because they don't control either house, then they might be able to score some political points. But I mean, the question is, you know, will this restoke those conversations about a pension you know, pension overhaul and some limited revenue increases over the next few years. And who knows if anybody wants to go down that road again.
And I will say that I alluded to it a moment ago. And sometimes I notice in the podcast that I'll say, well, I want to talk about that in a minute. And I never go back to it, but at the risk of making this too long. I do find it noteworthy. People, you know, people who know politics know him, but I do think someone who you have not heard talked about in pensions is Duff Sundheim before, who is the former chairman of the state Republican Party, was the chair under Schwarzenegger, seen within the Republican Party, and I have to preface this, as more moderate, pragmatic than maybe some of the idealists or ideologues or however you want to call them in the party. But clearly a conservative, as evidenced by the fact that he believes in this. He's also been a big supporter of the initiative to change political spending for unions and others, the Paycheck Protection Version 3 thing. And Sundheim, he knows politics. He's dialed in to the part of the Republican Party that has money. He brings a political reality check to this project that has otherwise been pushed by people who are more policy wonks.
Right. That said, I mean, there's been very little support up to now. I mean, he was asked about the money question yesterday on the call, and he talked about, well, we're viewing this in three phases. The first phase was to make sure we had money for polling and study. And
well, this was Dan Pelosi who was talking about that, yeah.
I thought that was
Duff. Wasn't on the call.
Oh, okay.
You had a bad connection.
Okay, yeah, you know. I joined a little late. Sorry, Duff. You know, but a lot of the money to date, my understanding of where the money has come from, it's come from out of state sources. I mean, even Duff has not been able to tap into to those California sources, and so it's not clear that there would be money because maybe because of the threat you mentioned from Dave Lowe that hey, look, immediately you get branded public enemy number one, or maybe it's the other issue we brought up about how there's no natural constituency. I mean, if I'm on my yacht in Orange County, what do I care about public employee pensions, really? I mean, if the state's bankrupt, isn't that good? If I'm a no government conservative, isn't that what I want anyway? So, you know, I mean, just a long, long way to go. And I'm always a big believer in downplaying any initiative proposal until a few million dollars shows up.
Well, let's transition to topic two then.
Speaking of a few million dollars.
A few million, a few billion. And also downplaying versus not. And
it's
that
about
is,
jobs, John.
Well, all of these are great factors. That's this week's announcement from the state High-Speed Rail Authority, a new projection of costs, timeline, how the whole project would ultimately work, the much talked about but still elusive bullet train from Northern California to Southern California, price tag of $98 billion to build that phase from San Francisco to LA/Anaheim-ish.
Just a slight uptick.
An uptick of more than half since the last projection. But if you go back to the bond measure that voters were asked about, where I think it was estimated to be $30 billion,
right?
The costs are different. There are a lot of reasons for costs. I mean, you know, every delay on this project costs more money. I mean, what I find fascinating is let's roll the clock back briefly. Think how long it took to get the high-speed rail bond measure on the ballot.
Right. They
we remember it was
postponing it.
It was scheduled for the 2004 ballot, then it went to 2006, then it ultimately went to 2008. So the plan that was being crafted, of which $9 billion was coming from the voters, is a very old plan compared to where we are in current dollars, current economy.
Right.
So anyway, $98 billion, which is a mind-boggling number to try to imagine. Backers say you shouldn't think of it that way. Think of it in segments. Part of it's private money, federal money. A lot of it would be federal money, according to their business plan. And I just find interesting two things. One, the governor's reaction, which was a wholehearted endorsement of the plan, because the governor has new appointees on the authority who, if you believe people talking, have brought a sense of realism. Anthony's about to sneeze. He doesn't want to sneeze into the microphone. Have brought a sense of fresh perspective of realism and pragmatism and transparency, I guess, is what you heard a lot of. But also, too, the fact that they are upsizing the cost estimate while trying to downsize some of the expectations, the ridership numbers, the, you know, what we can do, the blending with commuter rail systems in Southern and Northern California. There's a lot of politics involved here, and you talked about jobs. I mean, that's a number, you know, those numbers of thousands and thousands of jobs that, like, we have to really figure out how and when right. would we get them. I mean, that's a hell of a gamble. There's a lot gambling in high-speed rail there.
Yeah, and it does open the door for some, you know, Republican criticism of not only of the high-speed rail plan, but also of the governor, and we saw that this week. I mean, we had one senator calling for a revote, right, on the plan since
asking the voters to look at it again. Yeah, Doug LaMalfa from Northern California,
yeah. and more than one coming out with a little "I told you so" message. You know,
several of those. I think I got.
I got a few of those as well. So, and at the same time, you know, the governor has not shied away from it. Has said this is a public investment that's worth making, and thinks, you know, and has deemed this an important program for helping but it's such a vintage Jerry Brown program, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of far afield and kind of visionary, but, you know, questionable economics. I mean,
also vintage him in another sense, which it shows how quickly he can move from a spendthrift kind of perception to a don't worry about that, well, worry about the vision kind of thing.
Of the contradiction, right? Yeah. It's part of the contradiction of Brown. And yet, I mean, for those of us who've now, you know, been covered the guy for a year, it does feel consistent in its contradictory.
Therein lies our
impulses.
Challenge.
Right.
But think again about the financial element here. I mean, when those bonds are sold, the debt service interest to the state, that's only right. $9 billion of the $98 billion price tag, is about $1 billion a year in debt service out of a state, but out of a general fund that doesn't have money to pay for things as it is. And so therein lies, you know, a challenge for the governor. If you believe in it, how do you pay for it? Because that part, and that's only a portion, is tough to do.
And the counter argument to that is this is exactly the kind of thing government should be spending money on, an investment and an infrastructure investment in the future that will help create jobs. You know, so it's not some sort of, you know, public service handout or benefit or, you know, but that this is actually something geared towards putting people back to work and providing a service that will help the environment and the economy and everything but Southwest Airlines, I guess.
You look at, you know, the projections of what a ticket would cost and things like that, and you start to try to figure out what a consumer would or wouldn't do. I mean, certainly a lot of people pointed out, you know, there's a lot of debate about the Central Valley, whether it starts in the Central Valley or not. I mean, I know just as being a Californian, it's harder to get from the Central Valley to the urban centers of the state than it is from urban center to urban center.
How do you get to Fresno? You got to drive.
We've done it. You and I have done it. You were stuck in the car with me.
But, and you with me.
So, you know, some people will certainly make a case there, although, you know, the Central Valley is kind of the heart of conservative politics in California, and that kind of runs counter to the conservative nature of spending the money. But also, too, I mean, this is a project that's got a long way to go. And to me, the most challenging part of looking at that business plan and the financing was that more than 50%, if I'm remembering the pie chart and the other stuff correctly, is expected from some kind of federal sources.
Sure, why not?
Whether it's actual cash or this incentive or that or this program or that program, that's a very hard sell, it seems like to me, given what's going on in Washington right now. I mean, yes, we've gotten a lot more federal money because other states have turned the money down.
Right.
But that's still a drop in the bucket compared to what it would.
This temporary economic hiccup, John, you got to think big picture. Think big picture.
I try very hard. You sound like a man who is about to renovate a very old house.
Oh,
you can't get lost in pulling the boards out.
Are there any federal funds available for that? Because if so, you know, someone give me a call.
Yeah, that's not a stimulus. That's not a stimulus program.
Oh, but it is. All the contractors I'd be putting back to work.
You
would pour that money directly into the economy.
I think you should call the speaker's office. I think you guys might be able to get together on something. With that, that's Anthony York from the Los Angeles Times, as always, embarking on his home improvement project.
Always. Or at least henceforth,
yes.
If not always.
Chuckling from the sidelines in a newer house, will be John Myers from KQED. Thanks. We'll see you next time.